Blog Talk Radio.
Football, and I will get to it as soon as the show is over tonight. I am your host, Dr. C. Robert Jones, and today is Monday, November 22nd, 2010, Washington, D.C., the United States of America, planet Earth, third planet from the sun. Well, today has been a busy day in the news. In addition to all that is going on with the TSA and the airports and the impending staggering pile-up at many airports across the country as a result of the Thanksgiving holiday and Thanksgiving travel, we have news to report concerning our, of course, omnipresent Commander-in-Chief and the shenanigans going on in Congress these days with the Democrat Party. They continue to have us on the edge of our seats, just wondering what sort of foolishness they'll get into next. It's kind of like a precocious child. We wonder what's next. Well, the first thing I want to talk about, of course, is my favorite person in the whole wide world, and I mean that quite sarcastically, President Barack Hussein Obama. What Obama fails to understand, that's the topic of this particular monologue, this monologue right now. Well, let's start it off. Not 2 weeks after American voters handed historic victories in Congress and state capitals to Republicans who pledged to the last man to block the Obama agenda, President Obama said this of the newly empowered opposition party. They're flush with victory.
They're flush with victory after a campaign of just saying no. But I'm sure the American people did not vote for more gridlock.
Yeah, got the voice down. Alas, things of which Obama is sure and things that are true seldom overlap. If the American people's collective hopes on November 2nd could be distilled into a single word, it would be gridlock. Take this for example. A CNN opinion research poll the week after the election asked, do you think the Republican victories in the House races, are more of a mandate for Republican policies or more a rejection of Democrat policies? 70% picked rejection of Democrat policies. Exit polling showed that 60% of voters said the country was going in the wrong direction, 60%, and almost three-quarters disapproved of the job Congress was doing. A job, might I add, that was done in chief by Democrat congressmen and Democrat senators. So, regarding politicians, when one loses between two-thirds and three-fourths of the country, one tends to cling to one's empty rhetorical platitudes to explain one's frustrations. And so, the president, who spent months before the election oversaturating the nation's airports and airwaves to sell his agenda, said he intends to start getting outside Washington and shaping public opinion. The guy, either he is just stalwart and stubborn, or he's a complete idiot. Or perhaps he's simply desperate. Because after all, his puppet master, George Soros, bankrolled his campaign with the promise that Obama would fundamentally transform the United States of America and remake it in the image of George Soros. And as we know from previous shows and research, George Soros would like to see the overthrow of the United States government and the destruction of America's capitalist system in favor of open borders and an open society. Now, in addition to the craziness that President Obama has spewed after the election, the spin, the notorious spin, the president also went out of his way to scold, because that's what he does, the flush with victory Republicans by telling them campaigning is different than governing. When it comes to his own administration, however, Obama thought he could overcome the axiom with speeches. He is, as English historian Thomas Macaulay said of the Constitution, all sail and no anchor. That's what President Obama is. All sail. Sail, not sail, sail, and no anchor. He governs with wind, most of it blowing from his own lungs. All of it created to push the country rapidly away from its moorings. By contrast, the American people prefer a less jarring voyage. But Obama's failure to understand this continues to lead him into dangerous waters. And, might I add, America itself. This November's elections were not merely an expression of frustration with the pace of recovery, as the president claims, and apparently he believes it. They were a rebuttal to Obama's argument that every facet of American life requires comprehensive reform. But once again, Obama fails to understand this because he fails to understand his own country. Nothing better illustrates this failure than his predicting of presidential psychoanalysis to come. Bitter clingers. That's a quote from what he said in 2008. I'll read further. You go into these small towns in Pennsylvania, and like a lot of small towns in the Midwest, the jobs have been gone now for 25 years, and nothing's replaced them. And they fell through the Clinton administration and the Bush administration. And each successive administration has said that somehow these communities are going to regenerate, and they have not. And it's not surprising then they get bitter. They cling to guns or religion or apathy, to people who aren't like them, or anti-immigrant sentiment, or anti-trade sentiment as a way to explain their frustrations. President Obama during the presidential campaign in 2008. Well, since he spoke to those words, since he spoke those words to a room full of San Francisco liberals 2 years ago, what in Obama's attitude is different? Nothing of significance, nothing at all. Save the possibility that he has become even more detached and disdainful since his elevation to the presidency. Obama's analysis of the American people is unchanged, collectively ignorant. Their political actions are dictated by irrational fear born of economic hardship. This is what Obama told us during the midterm election cycle, that Americans were paralyzed with fear and thus were unable to think rationally. I'm paraphrasing, but that's what he said. Obama views America, Obama views American reluctance to stray from tradition, sacrifice individual liberty, and undermine institutional stability as nothing more than mindless superstition to be overcome by superior reason and logic. Therefore, the country is to be educated out of its prejudices by the enlightened deity Barack Hussein Obama. In fact, Obama sees Americans as so fundamentally ignorant about even their own behavior that he can and must explain to them that by removing Nancy Pelosi from her speakership, they were really expressing their desire that the House cooperate with him. And narcissism knows no bounds. This guy is a piece of work. He has got to go. He is the poster child for families sticking together and having a mom and dad in the same house at the same time, at the very least until the child turns 18 and goes off to college. People like Barack Obama, who grew up without a father, are simply and utterly damaged people. I've seen it time and time again. Over the course of my life, I have come to know people who, young men and who grow up with fathers in the household, heads of household, leaders of the household, and those who did not have them. Obama did not have his. And invariably, most of those people were troubled souls, narcissistic, and just simply damaged. Let's move on. The public has no idea what a service it's done by electing Republicans to thwart this president. Protest as we might, he would never have slowed the cruise towards his Euro-utopian fantasy land or our hope, because our only hope was to mutiny and drop anchor. We have done that for now, provided the GOP doesn't falter. Think about that. So, apparently, we're going to move on to our next topic. Bombshell evidence may make Waters an ethics nightmare for the Dems. Oh, not another scandal. Not another scandal. Oh, and Maxine Waters is black too. So you know what that means? Somebody's going to cry racism somewhere, somehow. After all, Maxine Waters is entitled to rob and steal and cheat and commit ethical violations. And, you know, she can hide behind the fact that she's black and she feels that she's being persecuted because she's black, like Charlie Rangel. Charlie Rangel marched in Selma, and he was a war hero, blah, 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 blah. And he marched arm in arm in Selma with Dr. King. So the hell what? I mean, that's old news. Charlie Rangel is a crook. Charlie Rangel should be in jail. If I did what Charlie Rangel did, I'd be in jail right now wearing the orange jumpsuit. Or maybe the stripe deal. So for our congressman, the dude who can barely speak English here from Georgia, who cries racism because Charlie Rangel refused to pay his taxes, lied, cheated, committed all sorts of ethical violations, all of a sudden, it's racist. It's a race issue. Somebody's being racist because Charlie marched in Selma 50 years ago, 75, 80 years ago. No, Charlie Rangel is a crook. So, apparently, Charlie Rangel's ethics trial was just the warm-up act. Because now we got Maxine Waters and that wig she wears. I mean, really? It is the most horrible wig I have ever seen on a woman. You got to be kidding me. Lose the wig, Max. All right. The New York Times reported over the weekend that House Ethics Committee suddenly postponed the trial of Maxine Waters on ethics violations because it found more evidence of a direct intervention by her office to benefit the bank in which her husband owned a substantial interest. If her husband owns a nice bank, can't she get a nicer wig? I mean, really? According to new emails uncovered by the committee, her chief of staff directly coordinated with other members of the House Financial Services Committee on behalf of One United, the bank in question. So, a newly discovered exchange of emails led the House Ethics Committee on Friday to delay its trial of Representative Maxine Waters, a California Democrat accused of helping steal bailout money to a bank in which her husband owned shares. That's the wrap-up of that. Maxine, take some of those ill-gotten gains and get yourself a new wig. My goodness. Somebody go out and take a look at a picture of Maxine Waters. She looks horrible. Will somebody get that woman a stylist? And someone to teach her to speak English. So, the emails are between Merkel Moore, Ms. Waters' chief of staff, and members of the House Financial Services Committee, on which Ms. Waters serves. The email shows that Mr. Moore was actively engaged in discussing with committee members details of a bank bailout bill, apparently after Ms. Waters agreed to refrain from advocating on the bank's behalf. The bailout bill had provisions that ultimately benefited One United, the bank in question, a minority-owned bank in which her husband, Sidney Williams, owned about $350,000 in shares. Please get your wife a new wig with some of that jack. The subcommittee's original report found that in early September 2008, Representative Barney Frank, oh my goodness, Barney Frank, I wish I could do the Daffy Duck Barney Frank voice. I can't do it. Democrat of Massachusetts and the committee chairman told Ms. Waters not to get involved with any issues involving One United, and that Ms. Waters agreed to refrain from advocating on the bank's behalf. However, the case against Ms. Waters hinged largely on a series of emails between Mr. Moore and One United, which may suggest that Ms. Waters' office continued to lobby on behalf of the bank, although Mr. Moore has argued that he was primarily on the receiving end of the message. So here we go. Another scandal brewing. And how much would you like to wager that Ms. Waters and members of the Congressional Black Caucus will cry racism? That Whitey is persecuting them because they're black. Not because they did anything wrong. Not because they lied or they cheated or they stole or they misled and it's blatantly obvious to all. No. It's because they're black. And there's a vast right-wing conspiracy afoot to cast black congressmen in a bad light. That's what they'll claim. Guaranteed. My goodness. What have we done here? So, it seems, let's move on to our next topic. Obama may face left-wing primary challenge. Democrats do not forgive defeat very easily. So, in the week after his, quote, shellacking, end quote, in the midterm elections, Democrat approval of Obama's performance as president dropped from 88% to 81% in the latest Zogby poll, bringing his overall approval down to 43%. Now, when a president starts to shed members of his own party, a terrible and vicious and wonderful cycle has set in, which can lead to a fine primary challenge, which I'm salivating over at this very moment. But not from Hillary, at least not yet. She's far too cautious and intertwined with the administration to be the first to move against Obama. Just as Bobby Kennedy needed a Eugene McCarthy to test the waters for a primary challenge to Lyndon Johnson in 1968. So, Hillary, she'll look to others to try out Obama's vulnerability to a liberal challenge. As with Kennedy, if it works, she'll probably jump in. And if it doesn't, she'll just stay on as Secretary of State, whistling past the graveyard. But there are three possible contenders who might enter Democratic primaries against Obama. Russ Feingold would be one, Dennis Kucinich, and then there's Jerry Brown. Wow, this pickings are slim. Let me repeat that. Russ Feingold, does anybody even know who he is? Dennis Kucinich, the Elmer Fudd of Congress, and Moonbeam Jerry Brown, California governor? You got to be kidding. Feingold, newly defeated for Senate from Wisconsin, has always been the body's most liberal member. The author, with John McCain, of the campaign finance law. He has been consistent in opposing the wars both in Iraq and Afghanistan and has staked out a liberal position far to Obama's left. As a former senator, he would bring gravitas to the battle. One of my favorite words, gravitas, means heavy, weighty. And as a defeated former senator, he doesn't have a lot to lose. Nope. Now, Kucinich, the radical congressman from Ohio who ran in 2008, has always been a populist gadfly. Now, ask Kisser. Dueling with the party's establishment. Also, a consistent critic of the two wars, he has the guts to take on the mainstream of the party. He showed he could do it in 2008. Now, with the wind at his back and Democrat disenchantment fueling his insurgency and the body count in Afghanistan, well, that's just gravy. Dennis the Menace might jump into the race. So that's two down. Who else? Well, the most intriguing possibility is the newly elected governor of California, Jerry Brown. He's run for president twice before, failed miserably each time. Most recently as Bill Clinton's major opponent in 1992. And has the prestige of a California victory at his back. I don't think so. Brown wouldn't run immediately, of course. He would need to get his feet wet as a governor. Well, 2 years of that. He's going to get more than his feet wet. But he'll soon find that the answer to California's problem lies in Washington, as he'll struggle to escape the financial mess he has inherited. More and more, look to him mixing it up with Obama over funding issues. If the president heeds the counsel of the Clinton years and moves to the center, look for Jerry to challenge him more and more openly. Eventually, Brown could declare that the best way to serve the people of California is to run for president. Once you get running for president into your system, it's hard to get rid of it. Whoever rises to the occasion or lowers himself, however, nature abhors the vacuum and politics likes it even less. As Obama struggles to compromise with the GOP House and to keep support from his terrified and slim Senate majority, his drift to the center is likely to spark greater left-wing animus. They won't like his budget cuts, and they will be outraged by his likely extension of the Bush tax cuts on the wealthy, $250,000. That's wealthy to some folks. $250,000. His compromises on the right will incite a candidacy on the left. Let's find out. I can't wait. What about you? Now, the problem with the cult of Obama. Democrats got the lowest share of the white vote in the midterm election than in any congressional election since World War II. They lost key races in Pennsylvania, Illinois, and Michigan. And every contested election in Ohio, that spells trouble for President Obama's reelection. No Democrat can win the White House without these Midwestern swing states. And they are still decimated by job losses that Obama has offered no roadmap to recover. Soul searching is underway at the White House, but so far it looks pretty sterile. There's no Dick Morris sneaking in with advice from outside the bubble or late night bull sessions with Terry McAuliffe about how to raise money and stage a comeback. Granted, some of the tactics these Clinton-era advisors used wouldn't pass muster with the Obama crowd or the common cause. But they shook up the White House and got Clinton out of his post-election funk and into a fighting form. Part of Obama's problem is that there's too much hero worship around him. Or just plain worship. And you know what that translates into? Reluctance. reluctance to fault him for anything, except maybe that he didn't make a good enough case for all the wonderful things he's done. The stimulus package, the socialist health care, all of that good stuff. I mean, it's just so wonderful. He's done good things, but the voters don't give him credit for saving them from a depression. They reward you for making their lives better, and that hasn't happened. The bankers on Wall Street are doing fine, but the other 80% of the country is hurting. And that's not supposed to happen when a Democrat is in the White House. Whatever will Obama do? This half-hearted soul-searching that Obama's engaged in wouldn't pass muster in an off-Broadway play. I mean, it's just so transparent. You can tell that the guy's not serious. Obama's storied political career took him from relative obscurity of the Illinois State Legislature to the presidency in such a short time that he didn't get much of a feel for the nitty-gritty politicking that consumes so much of today's partisan bickering. He didn't have the benefit of getting beaten badly at the state level like Clinton was in Arkansas, or having to learn how to reinvent himself. Clinton was the youngest governor elected in the state, and the voters tossed him out after 2 years, angry that he had raised car tag fees and housed several thousand Cuban refugees, many of whom had been prisoners, at a local military base. Clinton went around the state apologizing and getting an earful, and what emerged was a newly humbled public servant. One who felt the people's pain and whose wife seemed more supportive as well, trading her signature Hillary Rodham and taking her husband's last name for the first time in their marriage. Clinton has said that early loss, that it taught him more about politics than anything before or since. In his post-election press conference, Obama said there must be easier ways to learn the hard lessons of politics than getting a shellacking he and the Democrats got. There are, and if his aides weren't so in love with him and wrapped up in the idea of him as a transformational president, they might have seen this coming. Obama's problem with white working class voters surfaced during the primaries when he lost West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Ohio to Hillary. And those problems could prove lethal in 2012, not only for Obama, but for the five Democrat senators who are up for re-election in the Midwest and the Rust Belt. Obama is an undefined figure to much of the country, and to his fellow Democrats. Though he's portrayed as a liberal, it's not clear what he'll fight for. And he keeps that deliberately vague as well, perhaps hoping to deliver on a postpartisan promise his election represented. The fight over whether to extend Bush-era tax cuts is a perfect example. The White House needs to settle on a strategy and then execute it. Whatever it is, hope is not a strategy. And the extent to which Obama seems to weigh the political considerations of whatever decision he makes reinforces the voters' disillusionment that rather than leading, he has instead become part of the government, an implicit admission of his failure to bring about the change he ran on. What he needs are some hard-nosed policies to rescue the millions of homeowners who are underwater, plus a vision to revive the nation's manufacturing base to begin the long and painful restoration of jobs. He needs people around him who make him uncomfortable, who challenge his worldview, and who have a better understanding of the working of Capitol Hill, however dysfunctional it has become. People around Obama caught the lightning in 08, but they've been outmaneuvered by a party that 2 years ago was on the brink of extinction. Think about that. Well, this is not the end of the Obama presidency. It's far from it. But it's time to take courageous stands on behalf of working people so that these disaffected voters, whom we used to call Reagan Democrats, understand that their financial self-interest in what Obama and the Democrats and not only the Tea Party, because those voters will be smaller. There will be a smaller portion of the electorate in 2012. As more young people and people of color come to the polls when the presidency is at stake. But their voices count. And if Obama doesn't address their concerns, one party will benefit. And it won't be the Democrats. So, will Obama shift to the middle? Or will he continue on course and use the executive orders to continue to implement his radical agenda? Does President Obama plan to move to the center in response to his overwhelming rejection at the poll? Nope, I don't think so. Instead, he's moving to implement through executive action two of the most controversial items on his 2010 agenda: a carbon tax and pollution permit system, and a ban on the use of secret ballots in union elections. Through executive action by the Environmental Protection Administration, the EPA, and the National Labor Relations Board, NLRB, the Obama administration is planning to pretty much go around Congress and subvert the will of the people. Never mind that he couldn't persuade even one top-heavy Democrat Congress to pass either program, or that public opinion polls showed massive rejection for both measures, or that each is a sure job killer by itself, and together they're even worse. This arrogant, ideological-driven radical is determined to have his way and the public be damned. The EPA is currently soliciting public comments for its plan to use the Clear Air Act of 1970 to regulate carbon dioxide emissions. The Clean Air Act, as the name indicates, is designed to fight against pollution, unhealthy chemicals that are bleached into the air by smokestacks. It was passed to fight sulfur dioxide particles, nitrous oxides, and other chemicals that cause human disease. To use it to fight carbon dioxide, which we all breathe without ill effects because of concerns about global warming, is basically a perversion of the law. Worse, because the Clean Air Act is designed to protect public health by measuring aggregate pollution in each geographical area, it limits economic development in communities where the pollution levels exceed prescribed standards. But carbon dioxide doesn't poison anyone. It makes no sense to ban factory expansion in areas where the nature of the industries is that there will be high carbon dioxide levels. Like oil areas of Texas and Louisiana. But that's what the EPA plans to do, virtually making economic growth illegal in large parts of the United States. What is this guy thinking? I mean, when you hear about these things, I know it sounds complicated, but when you hear about these things, the things that this guy wants to do, you have to scratch your head and wonder why. So, Craig Beaker, the former chief counsel of the SEIU, Service Employees International Union, now the head of the National Labor Relations Board, has secured a 3-2 majority, party line majority, to repeal the Dana decision, which mandates secret ballots in unionization elections. The National Labor Relations Board will rule that if a majority of the workers check off that they want a union on cards, then the union would automatically be approved without a secret ballot vote. Without a secret ballot vote of the entire workforce. Currently, if a majority of the workers sign the cards, a secret ballot vote is then triggered. Frequently, the union loses these elections, proving that the card checkoff is subject to coercion and bullying. The Democrat majority in the Senate wouldn't approve the card check change. So the National Labor Relations Board is planning to accomplish the same objective administratively, going around Congress, going around the will of the people, simply bypassing all checks and balances. So they'll be trapping workers in the unionization. They would reject if afforded the opportunity to vote by secret ballot. Subverting the will of the people seems to be what this administration is all about. Time and time again, we see it. We hear about it. We read it. He says it. They say it. The president and the president's men are all about controlling citizens of the United States of America in almost every facet of our lives, including the right of a secret ballot. So, President Obama has not learned the lesson of 2010, and he likely never will. I don't know. I don't really understand I'm trying hard to understand what this president has on his mind at any given time. It just seems to me that he doesn't care what the American people think. He believes that because he was swept into office, that he has a mandate to subvert the will of the people and do what he believes is best. His narcissism knows no bounds. And even in the Middle East, President Obama is viewed as a problem. He was supposed to be different. His personal identity, his momentum, his charisma, and his promise of a fresh start would fundamentally alter America's relations with the Muslim world and settle one of its bitterest grievances. I don't think so. Because 2 years later, he's managed to forge surprising unanimity on at least one topic. And that topic is Barack Obama. A visit here finds both Israelites and Palestinians blame him for the current stalemate that they now enjoy, just as they blame one another. Instead of becoming a heady triumph of his diplomatic skills, special insight, and deity, Obama's peace process is viewed almost universally in Israel as a mistake-riddled fantasy. And as far as becoming the transcendent figure in a centuries-old drama, Obama has become just another frustrated player on a hardened Mideast landscape. You know, the current state of play sums up the problem fairly simply. Obama demands that the Israelis stop building settlements on the West Bank. Well, it was met at long last by a temporary and partial freeze, but its brief renewal is now the subject of intense negotiations. Meanwhile, Palestinian leaders have refused American demands to hold peace talks with the Israelis before the freeze is extended. Talks with Arab states over gestures intended to build Israeli confidence are kept. Well, they're a key part of Obama's early plan, and they've long since been scrapped. So, Obama has once again failed at every turn. He has failed to come away from the G20 with any promises that our economic future will become more stable. He has failed to bring about even the faintest hope of peace in the Middle East. He has failed and failed and failed and failed and failed. And the only thing he has managed to succeed at is nearly bankrupting the United States of America, and thus ensuring our overall fall from being the greatest nation on the face of this planet to just another Greece or France or United Kingdom. I got to tell you what, I am amazed that there are those who consider this man to be brilliant. Brilliant.
Brilliant.
He is a total and utter failure, and we have 2 years left of his failed policies to deal with. We have a Democrat Congress who is in denial that their horrible defeat had anything to do with the policies that they enacted. We have a president who is tone deaf and completely and utterly in denial that his policies were the reason for the historic defeat on November 2nd. He blames the defeat on people just being paralyzed with fear and just plain old ignorant. Oh, and he will admit just one failing, just one, that he didn't persuade us enough. He didn't get out to the people and talk to us enough. He failed to mesmerize us, hypnotize us with his oratory skills to convince us that he and he alone has our best interest in mind. That Barack Hussein Obama, our Lord, our Savior, has America's best interest at heart. That Barack Obama, he alone, will take care of us and look after us. Barack Obama, our Lord, our Savior, he needs to get out, he says, and mingle with the people. He needs to get outside of Washington and convince us that his vision for America is what's best for us all. Because we're just ignorant folk. We're ignorant peasants. We're clinging to our religion and our guns because we're frustrated and we're paralyzed with fear. And only He can save us. These are interesting times we live in. And I wonder, I hope that I live to see a brighter day for America, and not in the way that President Obama, well, what his vision is for America. I hope for something more. You know, if I have to put my faith in a political party, it would have to be Republicans. It would have to be the conservative movement. Because, you know, for all the talk of Democrats being about the people and for the people and for the middle class, they're for themselves. They're for themselves. They're all about power and accumulating power and more power. And worse, they're about using that power against the citizens of this great nation. At the very least, the conservatives are all about liberty, personal liberty. They're about people having choices to do what we want, to live our lives according to the way we see fit, and not according to what the government thinks is best for us. That's my, you know, that sums up my attraction to the Republican Party, to the conservative movement. The fact that it's all about us, it's all up to us. And the government, well, according to conservative history, Ronald Reagan, yes, and even Richard Nixon, was all about, hey, we're out of the way. You do your thing. You succeed and you fail on your own. And the government does not exist to take care of me and does not seek to interfere with the way I live my life, what foods I eat, what roads I travel, what kind of car I'll drive, whether I'll have to drive an electric car or one with a combustible engine. A conservative government doesn't care. We're allowed to do things as we see fit. A Democrat government is all about control and telling me what I should do, how I should do it, when I should do it, where I should do it. A Democrat government is all about control. Just like Maxine Waters said in a congressional hearing in 2009, that her wish, that her strongest desire was to see government controlling all of the major corporations in America. Now, the government can't even run the post office. They do a horrible job with VA hospitals. Have you ever visited a VA hospital? Just go take a walk around in one of those places. And we've all been to the post office. What a mess. These are government-controlled entities that are failing. And the post office is going into bankruptcy. But these are government-controlled operations. And they're horrible. Think about that. The next time Maxine Waters says that she wants, that her wish is to control every major corporation in America, and that our health care should be put in the hands of the United States government, the next time you begin to believe that it's a good thing for the government to have control over our everyday lives, think about communist China, Soviet Union, or even some place closer to home like Cuba, 90 miles off the coast of Florida. Think about the VA hospitals and the United States Postal Service and how you're treated when you walk into one of those places. Well, good night, America. And for those of you that I do not reach during the rest of the week, I hope you have a happy Thanksgiving and safe travels. I would highly recommend that you get in your cars, your combustible engine vehicles, and drive, and not take the airplanes and not go to the airports. Leave the airports to business travelers. Send a message to airlines and airport administrators that you will not put up with being groped and violated. The only way to get your point across, the best way to get your point across, is to hit these folks in the pocketbook, in the wallet. Things will change pretty damn quick. These policies will change when folks stop flying. So, I wish you a good night. A happy day tomorrow, safe travels, and we'll talk again. Good night, America. Thank you.